All right. Good morning, everybody. It is 11:23 and Monday, September 27th, and we're doing Chem 12B lecture. And we were on alkynes. And I'm looking to see, you do a screen share and we can look together at where we left off. Pop in. Come on now. Connected almost. This is the same thing that I did last time. Let's not put that connector in there. I did not. That's right. The connector messes it up. Perfect. Okay. Good to know. So this is where we left off with alkynes last time. We were looking at the differences between the alkynes. We talked about some electronegativity issues, acidity issues. We talked about the orientation of the pi bonds. We looked through and looked at the length of the bond for a single sigma bond versus an alkene versus an alkyne, and how alkynes are the shortest of the bonds. We talked about reactions. And we looked at the pulling of that proton and how we can make the alkynyl anions. And then once we make that alkynyl anion, we said that we could use the amine bases, LDA or sodium amide, in order to pull that proton. And it looks like that's where we left off in making that alkynyl anion. So today is really about, well, what do we do with that alkynyl anion now that we've got it? What can we do with an alkyne like that? And I thought, I did. I switched over to notes on the other iPad at that point because I was having issues. So on that iPad, we continued with that lecture. We went and showed how we use that. We looked at brominations. I'm looking on my other iPad real quick just to see where we left off. And this idea of forming alkynes. And then we went through the enols and the ketone enol, and we did 9-BBN to get aldehydes. So we did, we ended where I thought we ended. Which means that I get to pick it up after going through tautomerization, which means that we're at catalytic hydrogenation. Okay. So now I know where we're at. We've kind of reviewed everything. Let's start a new lecture. These are alkynes continued. And let's start with catalytic hydrogenation. So as always, what I tend to do is start you off with the familiar. We knew that when we had hydrogen and platinum, and we did this with an alkene, that we would get a syn addition of the hydrogen across the double bond. And that it would take it all the way down to the alkane. When we look at the when we look at the alkynes, the same reaction occurs. And so if we take hydrogen and platinum, we can reduce it down all the way, and we wind up adding two equivalents of hydrogen with just standard hydrogenation. And so there's no great mystery there if we have an aromatic system and we hydrogenate this, and we use platinum or palladium. We can use different metals, so we'll show different metals being able to do this reaction. What we find is that it will hydrogenate and that it will add the two equivalents of hydrogen. And the problem is that if we wanted to stop at the alkene, let's say that what we wanted to be able to do was we wanted to take this and we wanted to do just one equivalent of hydrogen. What would happen if we just did one equivalent? And the answer is we get a mixture of things. That one equivalent will do some hydrogenation where it adds just one. But for some of the mixture, it will continue to react and produce the alkane, and some of it will remain unreacted. And that it's hard to control. And so getting to go to the alkene is an interesting path. What we would like to do is we'd like to be able to just be able to do one equivalent of hydrogen and control it. But what we find is that because the alkene tends to be more reactive than the alkyne, that it's hard to stop until we find a different reagent. So here's an idea. We can take an alkyne and we react it with hydrogen. And this is 1 to 2 atmospheres. So it's more than one equivalent. We're using a lot of hydrogen in order to do this. But the reagent that we use is what's called a poisoned reagent. And there are several different reagents that will do this. So this is lead two oxide. So palladium with calcium carbonate and lead two oxide. This reagent in particular is called Linlar. And it is a poisoned catalyst. That's the way that we describe it. And it has the ability to be able to stop at the alkene. And there are several different reagents that are similar to this. These are all sort of Linlar-like. We have the palladium on calcium carbonate with the lead oxide. There is palladium on calcium carbonate with quinoline. Sometimes it's represented as just the name. Sometimes it's represented as the molecule.
These are all Linlar reactors or
they're all Linlar-like. So
they're like, okay.
Yeah, this
but one, the first one is the thing itself.
Yeah, this is Linlar. The rest are Linlar-like. Let's see, I had a couple of others. Palladium on barium sulfate. And there may be more. Most have either calcium carbonate or barium sulfate that will cause them to stop at the alkene. And so when you see a reaction like that, we know that we're basically stopping at the alkene. But it always, interestingly enough, when we do this, hydrogen palladium on barium sulfate always gives the syn addition. So it gives the syn addition in order to give the Z isomer, the cis alkene rather than the trans alkene. And that's because it's a syn addition of the hydrogen in the way that the hydrogen are adding. All right. In terms of hydrogenations, there are some other hydrogenations that we do. Rainy nickel, palladium on carbon, all those other things, same things as the alkene. So we can look at all the same alkene reagents. But since these give the Z isomer, what if we wanted the E isomer? How do we get the E isomer? So when we look at these, this is a syn addition. The syn addition gives us the Z, comes from the same face. So if we want to get away from this, if we want to get the E isomer, then we need an anti-addition. And that means that we need to change the mechanism. We need a different mechanism. And when we do things like palladium on carbon, or even the Poisson catalysts, where it's palladium on calcium carbonate, it's the palladium metal with the hydrogens that are embedded in here that gives us this syn addition, right? And so we have electrons that are going this way and picking up that hydrogen. And because these are happening on a surface, the surface is what leads to the syn addition. So how do we do this reaction and not have it on a surface? We change the mechanism. So this is the standard solid phase reaction. To change the mechanism, what we do is we look at a free radical reaction. So in a free radical reaction, we've seen this happen before, that when we look at one sort of reaction and then we change it to a free radical mechanism, that the free radical mechanism oftentimes will give us the other sort of reactivity. Here, what we do is we look at taking sodium metal and using it in liquid ammonia, minus 33 degrees Celsius. And this gives the one valence electron, gives the free radical, and the free radical mechanism, if we look at that reaction, allows us to take an alkyne and to be able to react it with sodium metal. And we don't really need the dot there, but in liquid ammonia, minus 33 degrees Celsius, this reaction is called dissolving metals. And it allows us to be able to go in and get the E isomer. It's an anti-addition. So the question is, how does this work? Why does this free radical reaction give us a different reactivity? And it gives it fairly high yield, 95%. So what we need to do is we need to take a look at the free radical reaction mechanism and see how it works. So let's look at the general reaction mechanism. And this is a reduction. So here what happens is we take an alkyne. Let's just do a general alkyne with R groups. And in the dissolving metal reaction, you have sodium that has its single electron. That single electron winds up breaking homolytically the alkyne. One electron goes this way. One electron goes that way, and that electron is added to it. And what we do is we break the triple bond. On one side, we get a radical. On the other side, we get an anion. This is a radical anion. The counterion for it is the sodium that just got created by giving up its electron. So there are two different hybridizations going on here. This hybridization is still sp. This hybridization is now sp2, trigonal planar. That anion is a very strong base and reacts with the protons in solution from the ammonia to take a proton. That creates this guy that's a free radical. And the sodium that is the counterion is now with the NH2 and has made sodium amide. Now another sodium metal gives up its electron, and the hybridization changes once again. The sodium is the counterion. And the reason that it goes the direction that it does is that the two R groups would have more sterics than the lone pair in the R group. And so it already sets up for an anti-addition here in that the two R groups go trans to each other. Another amide or another amine, ammonia, and the lone pair takes the proton. And we're at the end of the reaction. The reaction does not proceed and react with the alkene. The reaction stops. And we have two equivalents of sodium NH2 that have been created in the process. And so that's our general free radical reaction in the reduction of the alkyne to the alkene in getting the E-alkene and the E-isomer. How did that go? How are you guys doing? Everything makes sense in terms of that reaction?
So what's the difference between the kind of like the speed of those? It seems like it's getting a really high yield. So the twisting around or the R's go out of their way like very, very quickly. But the electron pair picks up that extra hydrogen kind of much slower than that. At the end there.
Well, I think
there's a timing thing, right?
Not necessarily. I mean, what you're looking at is you're looking at the difference between this guy and the anion. And this guy. And these can interconvert, and they interconvert on the order of a bond vibration. So bond vibration is 1 times 10 to the minus 12th, somewhere in there, times 1 times 10 to the minus 10th to 1 times 10 to the minus 12th in terms of time scale. And so that sort of bond vibration and equilibrium is happening on a much faster time scale than abstraction of a proton. And so that is equilibrium wise. This one is got a lot of sterics to it. And this one is major. And that's happening very, very quickly. So that's where that's coming from.
Can I ask you another question about the process?
Please.
So we have sodium metal that is got a radical on it. That's yep. Radical, right? And then we add it in, and then we have sodium ion.
The way the reaction is actually done is what we do is we take the round bottom. In the round bottom, we have liquid ammonia. So this is NH3. That is liquid, that is at minus 33. We add in the alkyne first. And then second adding in, we add in sodium metal. The sodium metal, as the reaction is taking place now, the sodium dissolves in. And sitting in here, in place already, is the alkyne, and then this sodium metal dissolves in, and it has that lone electron. You know, when we look at sodium, sodium is lithium, sodium, so this is 11, so this is a 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s1. And there's its one valence electron that is in the 1s orbital. And so sodium metal as a metal has that one valence electron. And so it's not existing as a free radical, it just has that one valence electron. And when it dissolves into this reaction, the radical itself has an absorption in the visible wavelength and turns the entire reaction blue. And it dissolves as this brilliant blue thing that lets you know that the free radical has dissolved into the sodium. And it's a very unusual reaction in that we generally don't think of metals as dissolving, but sodium metal literally does dissolve just like salt in water. It dissolves in ammonia, and ammonia has the ability to be able to knock the sodium ions or the sodium atoms away from the bulk metal and to solvate them as the sodium atom itself, neutral atom with the one electron. And then that one electron is able to participate in the chemical reaction, giving the electron to the alkyne, which then fragments from there. So this is a slightly different way than when we do this reaction. We had done... using NaNH2 as a base. In this case, it is the NH2 minus that is pulling the proton. And this is done in liquid ammonia too, NH3 liquid minus 33. They look almost identical, except for the fact that in this case, when we do this reaction, what we do is we throw in the sodium metal first. So Na metal goes into the liquid ammonia and we give it some time and it goes through that blue phase. Let me do a smaller arrow here. It goes initially through the blue phase where the metal is dissolved in here. And we do have the dissolved metal and NH3, but then it goes on to react because there's no alkyne to react with. It goes on to react to produce hydrogen gas that leaves the vessel and bubbles out. And it produces the sodium cation and the NH2 anion, and it goes back to being colorless. And then at that point, that is when we throw in the alkyne. And then we deprotonate it. And so it's an order of addition. The two reactions are darn near very similar. They use the exact same things. It's just that the alkyne is present when we throw in the sodium metal in the first one, when we're doing the reduction. In the second one, we throw in the sodium metal, allow it to fully react, go colorless before we throw in the alkyne to do the deprotonation. Otherwise, they're very, very similar reactions. Just achieving very different goals, though. And all controlled by the order of addition. Does that help?
Yeah, it helps. I guess, can I just talk through one more thing with you there?
Please.
So when we have the radical anion, where there's the, so where the radical is on the alkene where it's sp, and yes, then where you have the lone pair that is then sp2.
Yes.
Okay. And is that's just because the electrons causes it to bend right there and make it sp2?
Yes. So what happens is when we're looking at that radical anion, remember that radicals are much like carbocations, and they occupy a p orbital. When we have a lone pair, they occupy a hybrid orbital. And so when they occupy the hybrid orbital, it has to rehybridize. So now I have, they can't occupy a p orbital. They have to occupy a hybrid orbital. And so what I've got is a p and a hybrid. That means that this one is sp hybridized. So the carbon here, this carbon is 180 degree bond angle and is an sp hybridized. And this carbon over here is 120 degree bond angle and is sp2 hybridized. Because the difference is between what we see with lone pairs versus single electrons. So this is an sp2 hybrid that one's occupying.
Cool, thank you.
Which is kind of cool to think about, just in what that structure actually looks like. It's a weird looking structure for sure, to see lone pairs and a radical in the same place on the same molecule adjacent to each other. Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah. Trying to see what other reactions we have of the alkyne. And I think really only one more small reaction for alkynes, and that is ozonolysis, which is not used on alkynes very much. If we look at doing 1O3 and then the workup, and this can be oxidative or reductive, it doesn't matter. We get the same thing regardless. We wind up with two carboxylic acids in the breakup of an alkyne. And there's no way to control it otherwise. Both oxidative and reductive give carboxylic acids. With alkynes. And so mechanistically, why that's true, I don't really know. I just know that the additional bond, the additional pi bond causes the formation of the carboxylic acids, whether we use oxidative workup or reductive workup. And so it really doesn't matter which sort of workup you use. You just use whatever workup you have on hand and you wind up with carboxylic acids. And so there's a lot less reactions for the alkynes than there are for the alkenes. It puts us through the alkyne chapter much quicker. And we can take and make a good start chart. With an asymmetric alkyne let's go through and look at the different reactions that we can do. One of the things that we started off with in this is the ability to use sodium amide in liquid ammonia to be able to create the alkynyl anion and the sodium cation. From there, what we can do is we can take and we can create, we can react it with a primary alkyl halide. So we could look at this and say this could be R prime X, and that would make a new carbon-carbon bond. So that gives me that alkyne. From that alkyne, I'm going to slide this over a little bit. We can do a couple of things with that alkyne. That alkyne has its own little star chart over here. We could do hydrogen and one of the metals to reduce that down. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, to an alkene. We could take and use hydrogen and linlar or palladium on calcium carbonate with lead to oxide. And we can reduce that down to a cis double bond. Or we can take and we can treat it with hydrogen, not hydrogen, with sodium metal in liquid ammonia. And we can reduce it down to the trans. And so we can get different alkenes coming out of that in going that direction. We saw that we could take and react this with X2. Actually, let's not do X2, let's do HX first. I think that's where we started, with HX. This takes two equivalents we can't stop at one equivalent. And when we do two equivalents, this allows the two equivalents of the halogen to show up on the same carbon.
So if you don't do two equivalents, you just get worse yield.
If you don't do two equivalents, you get mixed products. And those mixed products aren't super helpful. So it's general to just do the two equivalents and just add both together. This one, when we do X2, again, two equivalents, we wind up getting the tetrasubstituted. We could look at adding water with sulfuric acid with H2SO4, or any of the acids really. In doing that, actually this also usually uses mercury sulfate. Here what we wind up getting is, first off, the enol, but that very quickly tautomerizes and goes into its ketone form. And so we wind up getting the ketone that comes out of that. If we take that guy and we use 9-BDN, and then two, we do the sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water. Here, what we end up with is the enol on the other side, which is transient and very quickly converts into the aldehyde form. And so we can get either the ketone or the aldehyde out of that. From there, we can look at doing ozonolysis, O3, and I know what I'm forgetting. No, that's, we got it, ozonolysis. And two, either reductive or oxidative workup. Same ones that we would use for the alkenes. This produces carboxylic acids. And in this case, would produce formic acid from the molecule that we have here. I'm looking to see, I think that's all of our reactions for the alkynes. It picks up just about everything that we need to be able to do from the alkynes. Okay, how's that feeling in terms of pulling together all the reactions and having a star chart?
For that 9-BDN reaction, can you explain what that is, where it's going to the second?
In the 9-BDN reaction, when we look at the alkyne, when we went through without 9-BDN and we picked up the proton, it picks up the proton and it goes to the more stable carbocation, which places the carbocation at that position where I have more electron donation group from the R group, and then the water can come in. And as the water comes in and binds to this, we go towards making the enol, which is the more substituted enol. Base takes the proton away. And without going into the tautomerization reaction, I'm here at the enol in that substitution pattern. And what governed it was really this step right here, in that this is the more stable carbocation. When we look at the 9-BBN reaction, the 9-BBN reaction turns that around. And here what happens is the boron adds slightly ahead of the hydrogen. So electrons flow this way and this way, going through a transition state. This is the critical part, where the transition state looks like this, and I'm getting partial minus and partial positive, and the electrons are flowing around in this circle. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get the buildup of that partial positive on that carbon where it's most supported. So this is the same thing as getting that carbocation on this position here, where it's more stable, as the more stable C+. The same thing is happening down below. This is now the critical step where I'm setting this up in order to get that partial positive, same place that I would have gotten the carbocation, right? Except that in 9-BBN, the way that I get that carbocation is that the boron adds slightly ahead, leaving the H- to add to that spot where the carbocation would be developing. So now, as that adds, I end up with the boron attached on the side with the hydrogen, the R group, and that hydrogen. And then when I go through and do the oxidation step, the boron gets directly replaced by an OH. And that then is the enol that can then go and, through a couple of steps, tautomerize into the aldehyde. So it's changing 9-BBN, changes the mechanism, and that 9-BBN allows the boron to go on this side, and wherever the boron goes, that's where the hydroxyl group goes. So it reverses the reactivity. Okay. All right. Let me present some ideas now. Let's take a look at well, the next chapter goes into free radicals. But before we go into free radicals, I don't want to go into free radicals just yet. I want to use this to pull together some ideas that we've been doing now, because we've been working in the alkenes and we've been working in the alkynes. And so I want to take a minute. The synthesis chapter comes up a little bit later. Before we even get to the synthesis chapter, I want to start working towards a little bit of synthesis. I want to start bringing all these ideas together in looking at alkene and alkyne synthesis. Or let's say synthesis with alkenes and alkynes. This is sort of bringing together everything that we've been doing, right? So this is the culmination of all of this work. And when we start to look at the synthesis, we've talked a little bit about synthesis. I know Zaruba talked a little bit about synthesis. The idea here is that the arrows signify multiple steps. Not how many. In other words, three arrows equals, or I should say does not equal three steps. It just means more than one. That's what the arrows mean. And so what we need to do is we need to figure out how to get from this alkyne to this alcohol. And what we'd like to do is we'd like to use the retrosynthetic analysis. So I know that we've talked about this a little bit too. In this retrosynthetic analysis, this type of arrow specifically means working backwards. Right, so we've got all different types of arrows now. We have a reaction arrow. We have equilibrium arrows. We have electron flow. And this is specifically two electrons. We have electron flow, single electron, so free radical. And so we have a lot of different types of arrows that we're using for different things. And we want to make sure that we use the right arrow for the right concept when we go to do something. And so this working backwards arrow is a double-sized arrow. And the way that we start that retrosynthetic analysis is we want to, number one, think about some of the things that need to happen. I think that I said that the first thing that I like to do is I like to map the problem. In other words, when I take a look at the molecule on the left, it has two carbons. And the molecule on the right has three carbons. So right there, this is going to tell me that what I'm going to have to do, one of the steps that I'm going to have to do is I'm going to have to add a carbon. I'm also going to have to add the hydroxyl group. So I need to add a carbon and I need to add a hydroxyl group. I may be able to figure out where these carbons sit within this molecule. So one of the things that I could do is I could say, all right, look, these two carbons here are carbon one and carbon two. Maybe those are carbon one and carbon two, and that this bond may be my new bond or my new CC bond, right? Didn't have to be that way. Could be this way. I could envision this being carbon one and two, and this being my new bond to the CH3 group, and doing it that way. And so this idea of mapping, the idea of mapping is to not only look at what has changed, but also locate existing carbons in the target so that we find where they sit. That's really helpful in terms of mapping. Once you have the problem mapped, I think the next idea that I told you guys was sort of a brainstorming. What sort of reactions can I use to add a carbon? How many reactions do I know that actually add a carbon? So what reactions do we know that add carbons? That we can make a carbon-carbon bond. How many reactions do we know that can do that? And what are they? Well, you got one that you're writing a formal report on, right? That allows you to make carbon-carbon bonds, and that's the whole important part of that formal report. So that's a Grignard. So we could use RxMg, RmgX, and that's our Grignard. That's one way. Another way with the alkynes was the using of a strong base, sodium amide, in order to make the alkynyl anion. And that's the other way that we can make a carbon-carbon bond, is with that alkynyl anion. So we got two ways to do that, right? And given what we're looking at here, given that what we're looking at is an alkyne, then maybe this reaction here is the right way to go, because that alkyne is already sitting there. So that's sort of the brainstorming part of it. Second thing is, how many ways reactions do I know, or how many reactions add an OH? So how many different ways can I make an alcohol? Well, to make alcohols, I know that if I start with an alkene and I add water and H2SO4, that I can put that alcohol in that position. Or I also know that if I take that and do BH3THF, and then 2 oxidation, I can put that alcohol at the back end. And so then I take a look and go back and I look at my substitution pattern and what's required. And it looks like, you know, if I think that this is the alkyne, and that was where the alkyne was, it looks like this alcohol is out away from where the double bonds were. It looks like I'm probably going to need this one. And yet, those aren't all the reactions I'm going to need. I'm going to need more than that. But at least this is sort of some brainstorming, that when I look at this guy and see what I'm being asked to make, I have some idea of the reactions that are about to go into it. And maybe that's from pulling out my star charts and looking at my star charts. Maybe that's because I've done enough problems that it's in my head. There's a number of different ways to be able to see that. But that brainstorming sort of step, map it out, figure out where the carbons are, figure out where the groups are, look at what needs to be changed. Brainstorm reactions so that you have some idea of the reactions that are going to be required. And now, step number 3, is plan a retrosynthesis. And this is with the brainstorming in mind, So I'm working from these brainstorm reactions and thinking about what it is that I'm going to do here. So let's start that off and let's see if we can't ask some questions and have you guys shoot back some answers. So the way this works is we always start off from the given reaction. I'll add those parts there and I'll use my retrosynthetic arrow and I'll ask, how do I make alcohols? Specifically, from what? What are alcohols made from? So I go back to my brainstorming and I see, oh, alcohols are made from alkenes. And so the answer is an alkene. And specifically, I would want to take it back to where the alkene sits in that position. And so maybe my mapping is not right here. Maybe I need to change my mapping around if I'm going to consider this as being my mapping. So if I look at this and I say, all right, maybe what I need then is I need carbons number 1, 2, and 3. And so these were incorrect. 1, 2, and 3. And don't be afraid to change things as you need to in order to make it work. Now that I'm back at that alkene, and I know that I can use hydroboration oxidation in order to get to that alcohol, now I ask, where do alkenes come from? So now I work backwards again and I say, where do alkenes come from? Oh, and maybe I don't want to do that sideways just yet. Let's go down one more. Let's take it down this way. I'm going to have not enough room. Where do alkenes come from? How can I make an alkene? What sort of starting materials do I know that I can make alkenes come from? Well, I have two options when it comes to an alkene, or three options I can think of. I could think of E2 reactions, where I could do an elimination to get an alkene. That's one option. Another option is to do hydrogenation and do it as a poison catalyst from the alkyne. And so it's possible that this could go back to the alkyne, where this is carbon number 1, number 2, and number 3. And now that I'm back at the alkyne, now I could work backwards again. And I could say, where do alkynes come from? So if I want to split this bond off and do what's called a bond disconnect and break this thing apart, then at this point, I could see that this might come from the alkynyl anion reacting with some CH3 group that has a leaving group attached to it. And this would be carbon number one, number two, and number three. And then that alkynyl anion could have jumped, just come directly from my alkyne itself. So you see how I'm walking backwards and I keep going step by step until I get back to my starting material. Each time there may be many different options and there may be more than one right answer. You may find two answers that give you the right stereoselectivity or regioselectivity. And that means that there might be multiple answers. There may be multiple viable pathways to getting this synthesis done. Sometimes there's only one. Sometimes there's more than one way. Sometimes there could be two or three ways. Sometimes one will be shorter than the other, which oftentimes is better. Although not always, sometimes greater selectivity is better. And so it depends on what the reactions that go into it. I don't get too caught up into which way is better. I mean, I will answer the question and I will show you which way is better. But for me right now, any way you get there is a good way. Any way you can get there works. And that's what's important. It's not how many steps you get there. It's how you get there and the fact that you do get there, regardless of the number of steps. That's what's really critically important. So now that we've done the retro, now we turn it around and we write it in the forwards direction. This is step number four. So now writing this in the forwards direction, we take all these steps and we turn it around. We start here, we make the anion, we react it with an appropriate methyl with a leaving group, we make the alkyne, we hydrogenate it, and we react it to make the alcohol. So we take the alkyne, we react it with sodium metal in liquid ammonia. We make the alkynyl anion. We then take and react that with CH3 with an appropriate leaving group. Can you give me an appropriate leaving group?
Bromine.
Bromine's great. That's going to make the new carbon-carbon bond. That's the CH3 group that we've just added on. This is essentially an SN2 step. We then take and we hydrogenate this.
You used one of the bonds up there, right?
Used one of the bonds up there. What do you mean?
It's an alkene, not an alkyne anymore.
No, it's an alkyne. Because what we did is we took this alkyne has a carbon that has a lone pair on it. The other carbon has a hydrogen. And this lone pair is the negative charge. It's in an SP hybrid, and it reacts in a backside attack against the methyl bromide.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. Kicking out that methyl bromide, which then makes the new carbon-carbon bond. And so that carbon is, the CH3 is now sitting here. And the triple bond is still intact. From there, we do palladium on calcium carbonate, or one of the others. Lead oxide. This will reduce it down to an alkene. Then we would use one BH3THF and two, sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water. And that would give us the anti-addition and put in the hydroxyl group. All right, how did that go as a process, watching that process all the way through? Okay, we've got 5 minutes. Now that you've seen that process, help me with this one. What's the difference between this problem and the last problem?
There's something in the middle.
Yeah.
Where the OH was added to the molecule.
Exactly. So the only thing that's changed between these two is where the OH is located, which means that everything that we did is still going to work. We can still go back and take this back to the same alkene. That alkene can be thought of as coming from the same alkyne. That alkyne can be thought of as coming from the alkynyl anion and the methyl bromide. And that would come from that guy. The only thing that changed was the one reaction. So help me to write this in the forward direction. Let's write it in the forwards direction now and see what we need to do that's different. So writing this out forwards, we take the alkyne, and let me show you that we could break this a little bit easier. We could do one sodium amide and two, we can do methyl bromide. And we can do that. It's two steps, but we can combine it into one arrow, sort of the deprotonation SN2 step. Then we would go ahead and we would do the hydrogenation. This is going to give me the alkene. And then what do I need to do here to get that on the center carbon as opposed to what I did last time?
You react it with water and hydrogen sulfate instead.
That's right. That's it. Nice. Water and sulfuric acid. And we're there. And so you'll see that many of these problems are going to be very similar and that there are just slight tweaks sometimes, and that learning these patterns is the important part in going through some of these. All right, I've got a bunch more of these for us to do. If you want one more to think about, I'll give it to you to think about. And then when we come back next time, we'll work on it. What if I wanted to do this? And I want to make that aldehyde. Notice that this is one and two, and probably one, two, and the added carbon three. This is essentially the exact problem that we just did, just with another small tweak. And so it's about seeing the similarities in these. When we come back next time, have a game plan. See if you can figure this one out. And then we'll work on it on the next lecture. Let's start off with that. All right.
All right.
Sounds good. Okay, you guys. that's all I've got for you today. Office hours. I'm trying to remember what time my office hours are. I thought they were 2:30. Maybe, are they 2 to 3 or are they 2:30 to 3:30? Let me look. I'm like, my day is, 1:30 to 2:30. 1:30 to 2:30 office hours today. And I will be back on at 1:30.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Take care, you guys.
Thank you.
Welcome. We'll see you soon.
Hey, Jason?
Yeah.
I just wanted to let you know that the rough draft that I sent to you, I just want to save your time, basically. Don't worry about looking at that rough draft. I'm going to read, because I've already added stuff to it. I was thinking about it. I was like, there's no sense in having to waste this time. So can I resubmit?
Yes.
On top of that? Okay, yes. Great. So that's what I'll do then.
Okay. Shoot me an email when you do that so I know to go look at it.
Okay.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Take care, you guys.